The life of General Belisarius. Belisarius's last campaign. During the last years of Justinian's reign, the apparent quiet of the empire was not that healthful repose which a nation expects and requires at the close of a victorious war, but the faintness of utter exhaustion and decay. The glaring faults and the pernicious consequences of Justinian's military system have already been exposed elsewhere, and the emperor, who even in his youth had displayed the timidity and vacillation of old age, daily became more suspicious of his soldiers and fearful of his enemies. In order to restrain the one without employing the other, he adopted the dangerous plan of paying yearly subsidies to bribe the peace of the barbarians and endeavored by subtle negotiations to stir up their separate tribes in a mutual war. Such an expedient might sometimes be successfully employed, but it can never be safely relied upon. Yet the emperor, says Agathos, treated the army as if he expected it to have no further occasion for its services. Thus the Byzantine troops rapidly melted away. The few remaining squadrons were stationed in distant provinces, and nothing was left for the protection of the capital but the corrupt and unwarlike Scholarians. The various tribes beyond the Danube, whose names may be comprised in a general appellation of Bulgarians, desolated the European provinces by many a predatory inroad, each terminated rather by its own satiety of plunder than by any opposition they encountered. At any length, in the 32nd winter of the reign of Justinian, A.D. 559, a more important and decisive expedition was attempted. Serbaggan, their enterprising and ambitious leader, passed the frozen Danube at the head of his cavalry and advanced by rapid marches into the midst of Thrace, where he divided his forces and, having detached one share to conquest or rather pillage Greece, led the other against the capital of Constantinople. Under his personal command, Serbaggan retained no more than 7,000 horsemen, but their number appeared multiplied by the extent of their devastations and by the terror of the Greeks. As the heathens, they were ignorant or careless of the sanctity of churches and of convents, and freely despoiled the first of wealth and the second of beauty, crowds of captives were hurried along in their train without regard to sickness, pregnancy, or age, and the newborn infants were left like corpses on a field of battle to the dogs and birds of prey. The long wall of Anastasius might have arrested the progress of Serbaggan, but its solidity had already yielded to time and decay, and it is compared by Agathias in his usual rhetorical style to an unprotected sheepfold where the prowling wolf, far from encountering a bite, not even threatened by a bark. There were no troops to man it, no military machines to play upon the enemy, nor any engineers to direct their use. Several breaches were open and accessible, and other parts were demolished by the assailants as they had little hindrance. Continuing this march from there, the savage chief pitched his camp at the village of Milesius, on the banks of the river Athras, and no more than 20 miles from Constantinople. It is remarkable that this was also the spot in which the reign of Zeno bounded the progress of Theodoric the Great. So bold and successful an aggression filled Constantinople with helplessness and despairing terror. The public places were encumbered by a growing multitude of villagers and peasants. Some escaped from the actual presence of Serbaggan, and others merely from the fear of his approach. The citizens listened with consternation to their dismal tales, and already beheld in fancy the sufferings of a siege, ending only in the conflagration of their dwellings and the murder of their families. Nor were their feelings confined to the populace alone. Senators and nobles were seen to mingle with it under the usual leveling influence of fear, and the emperor himself sat trembling in his palace. By his orders, all the churches in the European confines of the capital, from the Propontis to the Euxine, were hastily stripped of their most precious ornaments, and the sea was covered with barges, and each rowed with chariots, conveying these and other treasures to the shelter of the walls. Near the Golden Gate, where the attack of the enemy was expected to take place, a useless crowd of officers issued their contradictory and unheeded orders, and some of the unwarlike Scholarians seemed, at this significant expression of Agathos, to guard the neighboring ramparts. In this general confusion and affright, Justinian and his subjects turned with hope to the illustrious conqueror of Africa and Italy, whose strength was broken by old age and military labors, but whose heart was still alive to the call of loyalty and honor. The struggle was no longer for increase of territory or dominion over foreign nations, but for the very existence of the Byzantine Empire. And Belisarius prepared to crown his glorious life by one last and decisive battle. He resumed his rusty armor, he collected a handful of his scattered veterans, and his contemporaries were astonished at observing, amidst the weakness of decrepitude, all the martial spirit and the buoyancy of youth. The recklessness of personal danger which is recorded of him in this short campaign will be less deserving of praise if experience did not show that we cling to life with increasing fondness in proportion to our infirmities to render it painful and precarious. The first object of Belisarius was to find means for mounting his cavalry, and the horses of the imperial stables and of the amphitheater were added to those which a compulsory requisition obtained from private citizens. With every exertion, he could only muster 300 effective soldiers. They were veterans who had served under him in former campaigns, and they were augmented in numbers, not in a force, by a multitude of raw recruits devoid of experience, of valor, and even weapons. The Byzantine standards were also joined by a crowd of peasants who sought protection from the rapine and the outrage of the enemy, but were both unwilling and unable to encounter him. At the head of this mob of soldiers, Belisarius undauntedly advanced from the ramparts to the village of Chitos, in front of the barbarians, to deter the enemy of any immediate attack and thus obtain time for fortification of his camp. He was desirous to create an exaggerated impression of his numbers, and therefore dispatched outposts along the plain to kindle fires and beacons, according to a stratagem of the ancient Lombards. During the day, the place of fires was supplied by artificial clouds of dust, and Zeebrugge, deluded by their aspect, refrained from advancing any further against so extended a line. Meanwhile, the Byzantine general was not inactive. He sent secret spies to ascertain the real strength of the enemy, of which none but vague popular rumors had hitherto received, and by employing the peasants of his army in an occupation more suitable to their habits than warfare. His encampment was spread surrounded by a ditch and a rampart, and he labored to establish some degree of order in the Byzantine ranks, but found himself opposed by two different and conflicting obstacles. No courage, as we have already seen, inspired the great mass of his army, while on the other hand, his 300 veterans were flushed with arrogant and overweening confidence. Like most soldiers retired from active service, they probably boasted of their past campaigns and from imposing upon others by a curious common progress of the human mind, gradually imposed upon themselves so that at length they grew almost invincible in their own opinion. And they fancied that no barbarian, however numerous, could withstand their disciplined valor. They were impatient both of stratagem and of delay, and rendered necessary a public admonition from the general. In remembering, he said, quote, "Your ancient achievements do not forget the calm and cautious demeanor which secured them. Judgment and not headlong courage is the true arbiter of war. How else dost I and my hair already whitened by old age and my failing limbs grown unfitted for fatigue plunge into the toil and tumult of another campaign unless I rely on those faculties which continue unimpaired amidst bodily decay? If therefore prudence and good counsel can correct the infirmities of declining years, how much more will they not avail when you join them in full strength and vigor of manhood? These barbarians are accustomed to predatory inroads. Like robbers, they know how to rush forward unexpectedly on their prey, but they are little practiced in the art of disposing a battle with skill or awaiting it with firmness. Let us only observe the military discipline of our forefathers and restrain our rashness, and we shall teach these invaders how much a small but well-trained squadron surpasses a newly levied and tumultuous horde." End of quote. Thus, having endeavored to curb the impatience of his ancient comrades, Belisarius patiently awaited the attack of the barbarians. The sources for this include The Wars of Justinian by Procopius, Short History of Byzantium by Norwich, Byzantine Art of War by Decker, Byzantine Armies 324 to 1453 by Turnbull, and The Life of Belisarius by Mahone. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.